Welcome to concurrent session. I'm not sure what, I think about eight.
Eight.
Hey, maybe. On the quite interesting topic, I hope, of the portable long service leave schemes for the building construction industry. And I dare say there'll be some discussion about long service leave schemes more generally. Sorry, just quickly, my name's Wayne Cannon. I'll be the chair. I'll remind you of all of the things that I need to remind you of early on, and I'll remind you later if you could please provide your feedback through Summit Connect. The sessions are recorded, as you know, so as an often remote user of these services, living in the actual backwater of Brisbane, I think it's actually really useful to have those, because there's nothing more frustrating when you're listening to a recording and you're thinking, what the hell was that question? So please use the microphones and identify yourselves as you speak into them. Shauna's very happy for there to be questions throughout the discussion, so feel free just to leap up and wander over to the microphone we can catch things in the flow, perhaps, rather than waiting till the end, although I'd really obviously encourage everyone to be storing up some really useful questions and discussion. Shauna's framed this as a discussion piece, that there's much to talk about with regards to these schemes and long service leave schemes more generally. So I think that's about it. So without further ado, I will introduce today's presenter, Shauna Ferris. Has provided the leanest bio, I think, of the entire summit. But that's probably because she's very well known, of course, throughout the profession, and I dare say to everyone in this room. But just briefly, she's a senior lecturer at actuarial studies at Macquarie University, and the paper that she's going to be presenting today is a result of research conducted at the request of the Mackell Institute, and the research was funded by grants from the Mackell Institute and the Actuaries Institute. So I think I'll leave it there and with pleasure pass over to Shauna.
Thanks very much, Wayne. I'll start off by asking how many people in the audience today have actually been involved with any long service leave valuations or with long service leave schemes? Good. I'm hoping that you will all know a lot and be able to answer questions and give your opinions during the presentation. I must admit, 2 years ago, I didn't know anything at all about long service leave except that I would get some from work, which I was very happy about. And then this opportunity came up to be involved in this research project, and my first thing I wanted to say was to say thank you to all the people who helped me learn about long service leave. The managements of all the portable long service leave schemes were incredibly helpful about answering questions and giving me information and answering questions. A few actuaries, Doug Drysdale and Peter May, were the peer reviewers, and David Quinn Watson, who's also very involved with some of these schemes, were all very helpful in telling me where I was going wrong. I had to learn a little bit about industrial relations legislation and business law, so my colleagues in the Workplace Relations Department, who are co-authors with this paper, were also very helpful. But I'm hoping that many of you will know a lot about long service leave and be able to share your thoughts with the rest of the people here. So I started off looking at the history of long service leave. And in the public sector, long service leave has been around since colonial days, but it didn't really become common in the private sector until 1951, when the New South Wales Parliament passed a law to basically give long service leave to a lot of workers in New South Wales. And the reasons they gave for wanting to have long service leave was, one, to reduce labour turnover. Back in the 1950s, the labour market was really tight. Employers were willing to provide benefits that they thought might encourage their employees to be loyal and remain with the same employer, and long service leave obviously tends to tie people in, though the extent to which people take that into consideration when they're changing jobs would be an interesting question to consider. The second one was to provide a reward for long and faithful service, and the third reason was to enable employees halfway through their working lives to recover their energies and return to work renewed, refreshed, and invigorated. So that sounds like a pretty wonderful goal, for me anyway. Now, the reason that the McHale Institute and the Institute of Actuaries, or the Actuaries Institute, I should say, became involved in this was because over the last few years there's been a big push to make long service leave more portable, basically improve the vesting and improve the portability so that more people are eligible for long service leave. And in particular, the Green senators back in July 2014 suggested that the Senate should set up an inquiry to look at the creation of a nationwide portable entitlement scheme for long service leave. This idea had been kicking around for a while. A lot of union leaders had been making public statements encouraging the desirability of better long service leave. And one of the main reasons that were given were because the Australian workplace is filled with people who are casual workers, don't have long-term security. Job mobility is higher. It's arguable with the demographers. And that people were not basically staying in the same job long enough to get long service leave. It's a bit debatable whether that's true. I have a demographer who was on the research team here, and there is a lot of casual work, but even casual workers do tend to stay in the same job. Job mobility figures depend a bit on economic circumstances as well. During good times, people can easily change their jobs if they hate their jobs, and employers take on new people, so the average length of time people are at work shortens. But during hard times, the people who came on the latest get sacked first, and the people who hate their jobs stay in the same job because they can't move. So the average length of employment gets a bit longer. Anyway, so the Greens made this suggestion, and as part of the suggestion, there were some actuarial aspects of their proposal. And one was that there should be some recommendations made about how such a scheme could be paid for and implemented, which sounds like the kind of thing actuaries should be getting involved in. And in particular, they said, well, there are already some existing portable long service leave schemes operating in some industries, and we should take a look at those and see if they would provide a good model for expanding portable long service leave. Should we just create more and more of portable long service leave schemes based on the ones that already exist? So this is really where the impetus for the research came from. So my first question, and this talk has questions all the way through, and I'm hoping that you'll be able to give me some intelligent opinions. The first reason, is it really a good idea for improving the vesting and portability of long service leave benefits? I mean, long service leave was originally set up primarily to reward long and faithful service and to encourage people to stay with the same employer. Long service leave has obviously changed since then. Do we really want to expand it and extend it to more people? So if you look at the historical record, there's already been a long trend towards improving vesting and portability. So in 1951, when New South Wales first brought in long service leave, you had to work for 20 years with the same employer in order to be eligible for leave. If you left after 10 years, you could get a pro rata benefit. If you left due to the employer terminating you, or you became ill, or for various other reasons. In 1963, they changed the rules to make it only 15 years before you could get long service leave. In 1985, they changed it so you only had to wait 10 years in order to get long service leave, and if you leave at any time after 5 years due to termination by the employer, illness, death, domestic pressing necessity, then you can get a pro rata payment. So there's already been a long trend towards improving vesting and portability, and not just in New South Wales, even in the last decade there have been moves in different states, Victoria, Tasmania, to make long service leave more available to more people. And this made me think about, there's a lot of comparisons with the superannuation industry in this area, because if you think back to the 1980s, superannuation also used to be regarded as a reward for long and faithful service. I remember reading it in the actuarial textbooks. Why do we have superannuation? Tax concessions and a reward for long and faithful service. And there was very poor vesting for short-term employees. Often if you left within the first 10 years, you got basically nothing back but your own contributions with some pathetically low rate of interest. And there were no preservation requirements. All that changed as a result of the unions pushing for full vesting and portability during industrial relations campaigns during the 1980s. And, of course, the Hawke Keating government supported this because they thought it was in the national interest to improve retirement savings. Okay, so superannuation might be expensive for the employers, but it was good for the country. So the question is, question two, do we think Australians need more leave? I personally feel that I need a lot more leave. But you have to admit, long service leave does not exist in most other countries. Australia is practically the only country that has long service leave. So why do we need long service leave when other people don't have such benefits? Would it be better to actually cash out the benefits? Would people actually prefer to have a pay rise instead of having long service leave? Would it make what would be the advantages of just saying, well, everyone just, you know, gets a pay rise or gets extra superannuation contributions instead of long service leave? And so the question is, what is long service leave really used for at present? Now, when I tried to find out, the answer was nobody knows. There's an appalling lack, really remarkable lack of information about what people do with their long service leave. I spent quite a lot of time trying to find out if there were any statistics, but of course every company keeps its own individual statistics about long service leave. Even the public sector, who usually is a good source of data, doesn't have much data available. The ABS did a survey on how people use their long service leave, but the last one they did was in 1989, and I feel that that might be slightly out of date. And this was really surprising to me, because actually there's quite a lot of money goes into long service leave. When you think about how much research goes into superannuation, which takes 9.5% of your wages, and then compare how much research there is into long service leave, it's just amazing that this is a... No one seems to pay any attention to how people use their long service leave, except the only information I could find was in a few actuarial reports and in the ATO's data. So that might be something worth looking into. What worries me is, of course, that the unions keep pushing for better long service leave, but often there is no costing. When Queensland last increased its, improved its long service leave benefits, the Industrial Relations Commissioner up there had to rule on whether this was a worthwhile benefit, and he said the costings that were provided in support and against the introduction of improvements were totally inadequate to make a decision. So what can you say? So I talked to my friends, my research colleagues, and these are the ideas that were suggested. The demographer in our group said, we do need more leave because everybody's going to have to work longer. I mean, if pension age is going to go up to age 70, people are going to start work at 20 and work to 70. As if you're working 50 years, it seems reasonable that you should get a bit of a break sometime during the 50-year period. It's just tiring working that long. Second reason, and this came from also one of the demographers, was that there's increasing amounts of claims for workplace stress in all the workers' comp schemes and such like. Maybe if people took more leave and had a chance to have a break, this might have some beneficial effects on workplace stress. The data to support this contention is pretty soft. You know, people just say more leave would help people to not be so stressed out and depressed at work, but there's very few studies to back that up. Third one was when I looked at the reasons given in the legislation as to why long service leave benefits had been improved in the last decade or so, one of the main reasons given was to make it more family friendly. Said a lot of women are being encouraged to stay in the workforce longer, but occasionally there's a child who or a family member who needs more work, or the parents want to stay home and spend more time with the kids for a certain length of time. The existence of these long service leave benefits might help people to balance their work and family life a bit better. So the Victorians, for example, when they improved their benefits, this was one of the main reasons they gave. If you look at the statistics, people do tend to, if they have long service leave, they often use it for extended parental leave when a baby gets born. Instead of staying home for 12 weeks or whatever you're allowed to, they take a bit of long service leave so they can stay home longer. Carer responsibilities as well. More and more people are having elderly relatives who get into poor health and need a younger member of the family to help them out. The last one was interesting. I hadn't thought about this before, but if you look at what happened during the GFC, employers actually used long service leave. So if the workplace was having a downturn, they didn't have as much work coming in, they were in a financial crisis, they would encourage or even compel their workers to take some of their long service leave so they could basically reduce the capacity of their workforce for some length of time until the business situation improved. So there's several examples of that in newspapers and stuff. So, third question. So I don't know if I've convinced you whether or not you think long service leave is a good idea, or would you rather just have the cash? The next question is, do Australians actually need a more flexible compulsory savings system? If you look at what happens with long service leave, many people never actually take leave. The rates of people actually taking leave, from what I can tell, they're around about 10% of, if you look at the accrued leave at the start of the year and the amount of leave taken, about 10% gets used, and that varies a lot between categories. But again, there's very little information. A lot of people, the benefit of long service leave is not taking leave, it's getting a cash payment when they leave their job. Okay? So basically, long service leave provides an additional redundancy pay. People get sacked by their employer, they're entitled to pro rata benefits. It just tides them over until they can get their next job. And I looked at a study by the Members Equity Bank, which said that most Australians have incredibly low levels of savings. They ask people, do you have enough money to, you know, survive for a month if your income stopped? And a lot of them don't have enough money to survive for a month. So that extra level of compulsory savings that's accessible when you leave your job might be a very valuable benefit that, you know, the government might think, well, if they've got this money, then they're going to be less dependent on the social security system. It provides a sort of additional death and disability benefit on top of whatever they're getting from their super. Their long service leave is usually paid out. In some states, they're allowed to make claim hardship payments. Now, we all know that in superannuation, there are thousands of claimants each year begging to be allowed to take money out of their superannuation funds because they're facing some kind of financial hardship. And it's quite tough to get your money out. But some states allow people to take their long service leave if they're in financial hardship. Not all the states, but some. So that's another source of another valuable benefit to some people. Early retirement. I don't know about you, but I've noticed that the government is making it harder and harder to get your money out of superannuation funds. I'm going to be able to get mine out because I'm old enough so that my preservation age is 55. But the younger generation, it's going to be 60, and there are talks that it's going to be higher than 60, maybe 65. So people won't be able to access their superannuation to retire early. But a lot of people take their long service leave just before they retire, take 6 months long service leave. So it gives them a bit of flexibility to have some income and retire a bit early. Now, the government might think that's a bad idea, but I'm sure a lot of workers will think it's a good idea. And a lot of people just use their long service leave as a supplement to their retirement savings. It's just another form of saving where you get money when you retire. I did get some data from the ATO looking at... The ATO keeps data on termination payments, and this includes both unused annual leave payments and unused long service leave. And as you can see, the amount of lump sum termination payments that people are getting indicates that a lot of people are actually saving up their long service leave and using it when they get to retirement as an extra payment. So there's definitely room for more research on about what LSL is used for. And you have to consider, are these benefits enough so that we should be encouraging more people to have LSL after taking account of the costs involved? So the next question, which was raised by the Greens, suppose we do decide that we want more people to have long service leave. We want better vesting, we want better portability. What's the best way of achieving that objective? So the McKell Institute asked us to write a paper looking at the different options for how it could be implemented, and we came up with three different options. One of the options was the one suggested by the Green senators. Should we just take the existing portable long service leave schemes and extend them to more and more industries? So the first thing we needed to do is look at the existing long service leave, portable long service leave schemes and see how well they work. So there's not that many. The first one is the coal industry long service leave scheme, which is a national scheme. It got set up back in the 1940s when there was incredibly turbulent industrial relations problems between the coal mining industry and the government. At that stage, they were really the first private sector people to push for long service leave, and they managed to win it. And the scheme wasn't really very well managed at all. In fact, it was in deficit by $300,000 at one stage. Basically, it had no money. its assets were just enough to cover pay-as-you-go. But it got restructured to be on a more financially sound basis. But the coal employers, the big coal mining companies, have tried to dissolve this scheme back in 1998 when Mr. Reith were looking after industrial relations. They tried to get the coal mining scheme disbanded. They weren't successful, but there has been a lot of negotiation about how it works, and it's now switched from a defined benefit to accumulation fund just in the last couple of years. So there was quite a lengthy discussion paper about the pros and cons of the coal industry scheme going back about 20 years. The next one is the building and construction industry. There's one of these portable long service leave schemes in every state and every territory. They started back, mostly started in the 1970s, very strong union push. I think you'll probably, well, those of you who are old enough to remember, will remember that the construction, building and construction industry was also very proactive in pushing for award superannuation back in the 1980s, and this was just part of the campaign. They pushed for it very hard, and eventually all these schemes were created. Most of them were created in the 70s and 80s. Northern Territory didn't get on board until 2005, so they've got a fairly new scheme. In three states, there's a scheme for contract cleaners. And I was curious about this, and I thought, you know, contract cleaners, they don't usually have that strong an industrial relations bargaining position. How come we ended up with a contract cleaning portable long service leave scheme? And when I read up the legislation, it turns out that the employers were actually willing to go along with this, and the main reason seems to have been that there were a lot of disreputable contract cleaning agencies which weren't paying their employees any of their proper entitlements like superannuation and long service leave. And the reputable employers were all being undercut by these fly-by-night contract cleaning agencies, and this was a way for the reputable companies to make sure that the disreputable companies actually were providing the worker entitlements that they were supposed to be paying. So it created a bit of a level playing field in labour costs. So there's Queensland and ACT schemes have been going for a long time. The New South Wales one's only fairly new. The ACT has one for community services. hasn't been going for very long. The main reason that one was introduced seems to be to try and hang on to workers. apparently the community services industry has a lot of very low-paid workers in a highly stressful job, and they tend to quit and switch to other more pleasant, well-paid jobs. So they thought bringing in long service leave would help for them to retain their workers. Victoria considered doing having a community services scheme but rejected the idea. Tasmania is apparently considering it as we speak, so they might bring one in. The last one is the securities industry. That doesn't mean people who are trading securities. It means people who are security guards at buildings. That one's only just been going for a couple of years, so we don't know how it'll go yet. So I decided to just focus on the building and construction industry schemes because they've been going for a lot longer, and so I wanted to see how they worked. So there are separate schemes in each state and territory, but they do cooperate. They have mutual recognition agreements. So if a worker works in New South Wales for a couple of years and then goes and works in Queensland, he can transfer his benefits across. So they cooperate really quite well. The total is roughly $3 billion in total assets in these funds. They've got about 1 million registered members, which seems surprisingly high. The average benefit paid in 2013 was about $7,300. The way they're organised is there's a central register of the employers and the workers. The central register keeps records of all the registered workers. The data is provided by the employers. They have to keep the records basically for their whole working life. The registrar collects the levies, or the fund collects the levies. In most states, it's a percentage of payroll. In some states, it's a percentage of the building costs when they apply to build. The benefits are paid either by directly payment to the employee or reimbursing the employer after the employer is paid. They're all run on a defined benefit scheme where there is the benefits multiple of pay. Just keep an eye on the time there. Yeah. But pay is defined differently in each state and territory. There was apparently some rorting of the system where the benefits were based on your pay in the week before you took leave, and so people would suddenly get an extremely large pay rise in the week before they took leave. So there have been some steps taken to try and tighten up that definition a little bit. The workers can take long service leave any time after 10 years' service. So while they're still working, they can take long service leave and get a cash payment. They can also get a benefit when they cease working in the industry as long as they've been there for at least 5 years. This is New South Wales. It's different rules in different states. They can get a death or disability or age retirement benefit pro rata after 55 days' service. Now, the portability is only portability within a particular industry. So if you do 10-year service in the building and construction industry, you're eligible for leave. But if you do 3 years in the building and construction industry and then go and, you know, find another job working in a different industry, you get deregistered and you don't get any payment. So it's called the 4 years rule. You're allowed to have a break in your service for up to 4 years. So you can work for 3 years as a building and construction industry, go and work 3 years working as a shop assistant, and then come back 3 years later and accumulate some more service credits. But if you take 4 years off, then you're deregistered and you don't get benefits. So the building industry is very cyclical. A lot of people move in and out of the building industry. So this, in my opinion, makes the administration incredibly difficult. So one of the criticisms of these portable schemes is that many employees never get any benefits from the scheme because they leave before they qualify, okay, because it's a very cyclical industry. And employers complain about this because they say, I'm paying levies for people who will never get any benefits. Under the old system, before this portability thing came in, I never would have had to pay any money for those guys. So this has been one of the employer complaints. This is just the list of deregistered workers from Queensland over the last 3 years, and you can see 8.7% got deregistered in 2011, 10.0% in 2012, 11.2% in 2013. So it's a fairly high number of people going out who don't get any benefits. Another problem is the lost members problem. What happens is you've got someone who's worked for 5 years, so his benefit is vested, but he doesn't claim a benefit. Then he goes off and starts working in Woolies or something, and he never comes back to the industry. Now, technically, he's entitled to that benefit. When you leave the industry, and you've had more than 5 years' service, you're entitled to a pro rata benefit. But he might never come back and claim. He might not even know that he has an entitlement to claim. So all these people are on the books. Theoretically, there's a reserve set aside to pay for their benefits, but they're probably never going to claim. And it's really just the same problem as the lost members problem in superannuation funds. The four-year break rule seems to me to cause a lot of administrative difficulties because basically the actuary, I don't know if any of you here have done valuations of these schemes, they have all these people who've got some years of service. If they come back at any time in the next 4 years, those benefits will be accrued benefits that have a value, but you don't know if they're going to come back or if they're not going to come back or how many will come back or when they'll come back. I am certainly glad I'm not the actuary trying to value this scheme. It seems very difficult to me. Even worse, they might work for you in New South Wales for 3 years and then go and work in Victoria for 8 years, and you don't even realise that they're accruing more benefits until they actually put in a claim, because you don't have the records of their work in Victoria, but they do still have that entitlement. So is an industry-based structure suitable for a nationwide portability scheme? Now, historically, we can see why these schemes were set up on an industry basis, because they were part of the industrial relations system. There were particular reasons why particular industries wanted to get portability. But I don't think that this would really be suitable for a nationwide portable LSL scheme, because it only allows for portability within the same industry. So we have to decide, do we want to give portability to people who switch between different industries? Do they deserve LSL just as much as people who switch within an industry? That's a policy issue to be decided. But if we're going to allow for portability for people as they switch from one job to another across different industries, which seems desirable, then this industry-based scheme is just going to create administrative headaches. The administration, I must admit, the people who were running these schemes, they seem to be very efficient. They put a lot of work into computerizing all of their levy collections, computerizing their payments, making everything as streamlined as possible. They've got a national project set up so that all 8 of these different schemes are trying to pay for one really excellent back office system. They make really strong efforts to educate employees and employers about their responsibilities and to enforce compliance. It's a recurring theme in their annual reports. And it made me think, who's looking after all those people who aren't in portable LSL schemes? How many hairdressers and fast food workers are there out there who are entitled to long service leave and nobody's making sure that they get their benefits? Fair Work Australia technically is supposed to be checking up on employers and doing studies, but I don't feel confident that they're doing a really great job in ensuring compliance. So this is definitely a plus for these portable schemes, that they're making sure that people do get the benefits that they're legally entitled to. The costs per member are roughly the same as it would cost for running a superannuation account for a member. Might be like $50 or $60 a year. But that means the costs are really high relative to the size of the benefits provided. Because we said before, the average benefit paid is $7,300. So if you look at the ratio of the administrative cost to the benefit payments in the year, in the large schemes, like Queensland, it's $1 in admin costs per $6.50 in benefits paid in the year. That seems like a pretty high ratio. But if you look at Tasmania, the small schemes, it's $1 of admin costs per every $3.70 in benefits paid. So if we do have a portable long service leave schemes, the issue of efficiency in the schemes is going to be really an important issue. And going back to the same problems we see in the superannuation industry, compulsory super started out with 100 maybe, small superannuation funds, industry-based. Over the years, it was recognised that the small funds are just not economic, they're not cost effective, and they all merged to form these, you know, off-super type organisations. So it seems to me we don't want to repeat that mistake. We don't want to set up a lot of small industry-based portable LSL schemes which are going to have unacceptably high administration costs. It just seems to me it's not the way to go. Investment performance, we're getting to more actuarial issues. Most of these funds invested a lot of money in growth assets, which has led to rather alarming volatility in their investment returns. The first graph's New South Wales. You can see they had minus 10% returns in 2008 and 2009. Tasmania had minus 29% returns in 2009. It's a bit strange. The annual report for 2009 said the return was minus 29%. But a couple of years later, they amended it to be minus 17%. I'm still not sure exactly what happened. I don't know if their first calculation was a mistake or if they just decided they didn't want to talk about minus 29% anymore.
Returns from fund managers?
Anyway, so the result of all this volatility has been huge surpluses and deficits in these schemes. And this is a real actuarial issue. During the 1990s, all of the funds had accumulated huge surpluses. But during the GFC, most of the funds developed substantial deficits. They've largely recovered by now because they, A, pushed up their levies quite sharply, and they had better investment performance. So if you look on the first column, that's the asset-to-liability ratio at the end of 2009. So you can see New South Wales had a 20% deficit, Queensland had an 18% deficit, South Australia had a 12% deficit, Victoria had a 23% deficit, Western Australia had a 75% deficit. Now, it seems to me if you were a member of one of these funds, you might not be happy about this situation. most of them have recovered. Victoria still seems to be a bit in the doldrums. So the question here is, how well are these assets, surpluses and deficits being managed? The first problem is, how did they use their surpluses? As soon as there was a huge surplus, there was a lot of pressure to improve the benefits. The union movements pushed very hard for benefit improvements. The problem is that the benefit improvements were permanent, but the surplus was temporary. So the benefits have all been... you probably have seen this before in superannuation funds, if you run defined benefit funds. So there's now higher long-term costs for the employer, despite the fact that the surplus is gone. So the people in these funds actually have better than benefits than the community average. The second problem was that all these surpluses and deficits have caused a lot of instability in the levy rates. I'm running out of time. So if you look, this is the Victorian levies. It was 0% for many years, jumped up to 1.5%, then to 2%, and it's now 2.5%. Western Australia, very lumpy. They change their rates more often. But it's been down as low as 0.25% and up as high as 2.25% with fairly frequent changes. Australian Capital Territory, 1% for a long time. I'm told the employers strongly resisted increases in the levy, so they deferred increasing the levy, but finally they bit the bullet and said, yes, we'll have to go up to 2.5%. Tasmania had very low levies for a while and then a very sharp increase after the GFC. Now, this was very unfortunate for the Tasmanian scheme because there was a parliamentary inquiry at that time in 2011 and all the employers complained bitterly about the very sharp increases in the levies. So the consequences are they're very unhappy employers, which came out at the Tasmanian inquiry. They complained that these levies were making them uncompetitive with out-of-state building and construction manufacturers, people who made window frames or kitchen, self-made kitchens or whatever. There's also generational cross-subsidy issues because the new employers who are entering the industry are now paying high levies to pay off deficits that were incurred 5 years ago before they even got into the business. They're not happy. And the whole effect is very pro-cyclical. The building industry is very cyclical. So when there's a downturn, you have a lot of payments leaving, so they demand their payments, so payments go up. The level of building activity plummets, so you get a lot less income coming in. The scheme has to charge higher levies to cover the investment losses that they're making, and the deficits also rise from valuation assumptions being weaker, lower expectations of future long-term returns. So basically the question we have to ask ourselves is a defined benefit structure suitable for a multi-employer scheme like this, where there's inevitably going to be swings and roundabouts, especially when, like in the contract cleaning industry, the average employer seems to last like a very short time, very high turnover of employers. So some pay nothing, some pay a lot, depending on where they come in during the business cycle. And what, if anything, can be done to reduce the variability in the levy rates? Now, some people would say, well, we shouldn't just constantly change the levy rates up and down. We should just set a long-term rate and let swings and roundabouts happen. There'll be a surplus every now and then. There'll be a deficit every now and then. That's just what you expect when you've got volatile investment strategy. The question is, are deficits acceptable to the members? If you were a member of a fund that only had a 75% funding ratio, would you be worried about your benefits? On the other hand, are surpluses politically feasible? As far as I can tell, whenever there's a surplus, everybody puts their hand out to grab it. And it would be very difficult for the management of the scheme to resist the demands for that surplus to be used up for the benefit of somebody or other. Historically, that's what seems to happen. So, for example, during the 1990s, when the funds had a large surplus, Bob Carr, who was the New South Wales Premier at the time, simply said, the fund has an extra $180 million, the New South Wales government has a budget deficit. Problem solution. You know. So he basically just took all the money out of the fund in 1995 and 1996, and then the next year the levies had to go up again because the surplus wasn't there anymore, and the employers were all very unhappy, but there was nothing they could do about it because the government was running the fund. The Queensland government was a bit more subtle. They just took the surplus and used it to create a, quote, training fund. I don't know exactly what the training fund was used for, but Mr. Cole seemed to be a bit worried about it. Royal Commissioner. Royal Commissioner Cole did a study of the building and construction industry in 2003, and he said basically this is not on. If it's long service leave money, it should be used for long service leave. Other people shouldn't be able to take the surplus out just because, you know, they'd like to have some extra money. That's not how it's supposed to work. So there's a quote from the Royal Commissioner. I consider that long service leave money should be used only for the purposes for which they were paid. I can see no justification for imposing upon the industry a levy by legislation for long service leave and then using portions of the funds so raised for other purposes. So there's some corporate governance issues here in the management of these funds. At the moment, in 2012, the New South Wales Fund had a huge deficit. So you might think, well, the New South Wales government, when there was a surplus, they took out all the money. When there's a deficit, surely they should give the money back to cover the deficit. But apparently not. When this huge deficit arose, the New South Wales government announced that it was considering privatising the fund, which presumably will mean that it is no longer financially responsible for any of the deficits. These seem to me to be the ownership of assets, surpluses and deficits seems to me to be an issue that needs to be resolved before we create any more of these funds. Does that mean I've got 5 minutes left or I'm already over time?
We're already over time as far as discussion is concerned. So that means 5 minutes until the doors open and a dash of water comes through the...
I'll just say the last thing. I've got about two more slides. So one of the issues that was brought up by the actuaries I spoke to was the whole issue of the valuation basis for liability. So this came up when I was looking at the New South Wales Fund. The valuation of the liabilities is very sensitive to the assumptions about the long-term discount rate. So in 2012, the New South Wales Fund used a valuation rate based on the government bond rate, which of course was quite low due to having a GFC, you know, interest rates are quite low at the moment. So they actually had a negative gap. They assumed that they would only earn 3% while wages were growing at 4%, so the gap was negative 1%. The next year, the actuaries talked to the auditors, persuaded them that it would be more sensible to use a rate of discount that reflected the long-term expected returns on their actual asset mix, which was very growth-oriented. So they put the discount rate up to 7%, which meant that they had a plus 3% gap instead of a minus 1% gap. And the difference, which is recorded in the annual report, is that the change of assumptions meant that the deficit went down by $54 million. So instead of having liabilities of $831 million, they had liabilities of $777 million, which made their solvency position look a lot better. They still had a deficit, but it was a smaller deficit. Okay? So the question is, for the actuarial profession, is what is the appropriate discount rate to use in the valuation of these liabilities? Apparently the accounting standard is a bit ambiguous about what should be used, and different schemes use different methods for determining the discount rate. Some use long-term government bond rate, some use expected return on assets. You guys tell me, you're the practicing actuaries, which method is preferable for financial reporting? If we think that this is an important issue, should the Actuaries Institute be making recommendations to the Accounting Standards Board as to what should be done? My conclusion is just the portable schemes that I looked at do seem to be working well. They've got pretty good customer satisfaction. The employers support them. The employees support them. They're paying a lot of benefits that people wouldn't otherwise get. But for the reasons given in this presentation, I don't really think we should be adopting this industry-based model for the extension of portable long service leave to the wider community. So the challenge for you guys is to think up a better way, assuming that we do want to extend long service leave, and I don't know if we do, there has to be a better way than this to do it. What do you think we could come up with? Okay? Thanks.
So we're going to have to rush with questions. Thank you very much, Shauna. Michael.
Michael Burt. Quick question, Shauna. Did you think about the UniSuper approach, which is that you have the fixed contribution rate and a variable defined benefit outcome?
Well, seeing that the UniSuper has just cut its benefits to all of us, I don't think that's a very workable system. We just had the UniSuper had a $1 billion deficit, and we got all the members of the fund got a benefit reduction starting from the 1st of January. So from my perspective, I don't think that's a really great outcome. But I mean, I think there really is, if you're going to have a portable scheme, I think you really have to seriously think about whether you're going to have an accumulation-type scheme instead of a defined benefit scheme. It means the members will bear the risk. They might not have such... The benefit that they get when they take long service leave might not be enough to cover 2 months' salary. But I just don't see how you can make a defined benefit scheme work with a lot of different employers.
Especially when... not many people actually take leave in service. They use it for other savings means and all sorts of other things. Perhaps a long-term savings approach is not so unreasonable. Sorry, I shouldn't be jumping in. Any other questions, please?
Quick one. really just a comment echoing that. I think of all of that, let's not even bother talking about discount rates. And so if this whole industry, the whole issue is governance.
Yeah.
The question is, they don't need to worry about what the discount rate is. I don't know how much oversight is being exerted. It seems there's a trough of money here. Everyone's having a good time with it, which is not...
Well, that's another reason why an accumulation scheme is better, because if an accumulation scheme, everybody knows how much money is supposed to be in their account.
Exactly, I'd agree.
It's a big change in thinking, because long service leave benefits have been defined benefits since 1901, when the Commonwealth first passed the legislation for it. So big change in thinking. But it's the same with superannuation. We used to have a lot of defined benefit super funds. Now we have a lot of accumulation funds. Defined benefit funds aren't around much. I think when you switch to this vesting and portability stuff, accumulation begins to look a lot more sensible. Yeah.
Deb Jones Breton wasn't... I did just think then, though, that we perhaps don't have quite those same issues around some of our really large schemes, such as workers' comp schemes, that would say they have decreased. There's better governance and better management, I think, in a lot of respects. And so if you end up with a really, really large scheme and good oversight, then maybe you can manage some of those issues a little bit better and spread your risk and all that sort of thing. Just a comment, if you did want to do some research, which I think would be really interesting, on the impact of leave on stress, you could look at school teachers and how much sick leave they take in November compared to how much sick leave they take in, say, March.
Yeah.
Because I know my mother-in-law worked at a school, and she said the teachers were almost unrecognisable in February compared to what they looked like in December.
Not just teachers, university lecturers are exactly the same, I'll tell you that. So that does seem to me to be an issue that there might be a lot of public interest in. Because mental health claims and stress and depression and stuff is going to be so expensive that if there's any possibility that there could be measures taken that will help to alleviate those problems, I think there'd be a lot of interest in the outcomes. Yeah.
Okay, well, the water's just about to gush through, so let's wrap things up. Please join me again in thanking Shauna for the presentation and all the work.
Well, thank you.